Good evening, everyone. You are listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. This is Reverend Jennifer Hope Kotler, and I'm your host this evening. This is Monday night, October the 28th, but unfortunately, actually not 28th, it's October the 27th, and we are not coming to you live, as we usually do, but we are coming to you pre-recorded, and I'm really I'm excited tonight about the guest that we have on with us tonight. Doug Padgett is the founding pastor of Solomon's Porch, which is a ministry in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'll let him correct me if I get any of this wrong. And he is also the founding director of Convergence, which is a new progressive Christian movement, and all kinds of other stuff, author of several books. And so, Doug, what other things do our listeners need or want to know about you?
Oh, hi, Jen. Well, they should know that I'm thrilled to be on your show. That's the highlight of my day. I'm thrilled to talk with you about all the good things you're doing. And, you know, there's just so many exciting things that happen in the world. You know, I mean, I know the headlines are filled with both sides of the story, a lot of the struggles and a lot of the pains and difficulties in the world. But boy, there's some exciting things that are going on in the, in creativity and spirituality and communities that are forming. And so I think it's good for people to know I sort of have a rosy outlook on things. And it's not because I don't, it's not because I don't see the difficulty, but even in the midst of the difficulty, I think is what makes the upsides seem so much brighter. So,
yeah,
I
completely
talk about
agree.
All the
yeah.
Things going on. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks. I'm so glad that you were able to tape and to join us tonight. I know that things get very busy. So let's start by how did you get started in this our progressive Christian movement, and where did the ideas for Solomon's Porch come from? When did that start? Sort of all of the above.
Yeah. So I was raised here in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul area, in a family that didn't go to church at all ever. I had was in one of those intentionally non-religious families. I like to say there was a church on every corner that we didn't go to on purpose. But that didn't mean I didn't have a real sense of God. Like, I thought a lot about God for whatever reason, but didn't really have a frame or a context to think about that within. I had friends who were clearly religious when I was little, but I didn't know any of that. What the details were, it didn't make much difference to me if someone was a Lutheran or a Jewish or Catholic or whatever. Like, those weren't in important sort of frames to me even into high school. Like, I didn't think about that very much. And I didn't know anything about the Christian story at all. And when I was a junior in high school, a friend invited me to go with him to a thing called a Passion Play, which are these like live performances done around Easter time that tell the story of the last week of Jesus's life. And I didn't even know what that was. My friend had invited me to go downtown Minneapolis to see something called a Passion Play, and I didn't have any expectation that it was going to be about Jesus. That kind of title doesn't really lend itself to that conclusion.
Right.
So I really
I
didn't know.
Raised a Christian, and I had a friend who was Greek Orthodox who had invited me to a Passion Play in the city of Pittsburgh. And even growing up Christian, I had no idea what a Passion Play was.
Oh, is that right? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like it could have been a very risque thing, with that title. Did you go with that friend of yours?
I did. And it was fascinating. Yeah.
Well, I went April 1st, 1983. Do you know when you went?
No. I'm not sure.
No.
Yeah.
Well, and I only remember that because it was kind of a marked day in my life, because it was, I only noticed that day because I reflected on it quite often, and it was April Fool's Day. Right. So I always like to remind myself that my first experience in Christianity was on April Fool's Day. But there was something in, well, I didn't know anything about Christianity at all. Like, quite literally, I didn't know Christmas and Easter were connected to each other. Like, I didn't pay any attention. I wasn't the smartest kid in class, you know? But like, if you don't go to those, if you don't do religious things on those days, it's really hard to know kind of how they fit, with one another. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I didn't know anything. Like, and I thought that the highlight of the story was going to be Jesus's act of forgiveness, you know, while being crucified. Because it was clear to me in this play that Jesus was on the side of humanity and was saying that God was on the side of humanity and there was nothing that separated God and humanity, and that he was protecting the weak from the abusive powerful. And I knew that story in my own life. And so, like, this was a very pregnant, real story to me that I was sort of watching, you know. I had this vision in my head that sort of what a righteous person would do in the world is to go around and right wrongs, you know, sort of like a hero kind of thing, you know, like a Batman sort of thing. Or for me, it was
superheroes
really I'd watched a movie in the early 70s when I was a little kid called Billy Jack. And Billy Jack was this guy that was protecting these native kids from the oppressive sheriff in town. And I really captured that idea. I really liked it. He used karate and all this kind of stuff. And so I kind of thought, you know, that's what you should do, is go fight these injustices. And then in this Jesus story, I see this much broader vision of how love and forgiveness and grace and movement and resistance is much better than violence and fighting to fight against or to be a counter to the evil in the world and so on. And so this story totally captivated me, right? And I was just really into it. And then the resurrection happens, and that seems to be just spectacular, you know, that even death can't bring an end to the life that God wants to breathe into every situation. And it was just fantastic. But then this funny thing happened. We went backstage of the to meet with some people, because they did this little thing at the end where they said, hey, if this story's been meaningful to you, you know, we have some people here that would love to tell you more about it. So we go backstage and we sit around in these little this circle of chairs, you know, and they hand out booklets. And immediately this all seems so different than what was out on the stage. Like, out on the stage in the play, there was like passion and there was people and there was this narrative of God's engagement and everything. And then we go backstage and it turns into like steps and stages and booklets and pages and pamphlets, you know, like the whole thing is now broken down. And I remember sitting there, because I was reflecting on this just days later, like, and there was in the booklet, there was like this diagram that has a canyon. It's a really famous thing in some versions of Christianity where God is on one side of a canyon and humans are on the other side of a canyon and they can't get to each other, you know, and there's this big gaping hole between the two. And I was confused as to why God would be trapped on the far side of a canyon. You know, it didn't seem very godlike.
But it didn't jive with what you had just bought, right?
That's right. I mean, I'm just sitting there like, well, did you people even see the story out on the stage, you know? So it was really, I felt myself like simultaneously spiritually alivened. Like, that is the story that I want to be true in my life and I think has been resounding in me all along. And then on the other hand, I found myself like arguing with the version of Christianity that people were telling me my first 5 minutes inside the faith, you know. And that kind of thing has never really gone away, right? Like, it just, I get it that all of us tell of the faith of God and Jesus and whatever, if Jesus is our narrative, that we all tell that story in ways that make sense to us, and that won't necessarily always fit for other people. And we shouldn't expect that it would, you know, it's just impossible. Like, the story of God and the story of humans and everyone's experience is too vast and too expansive and too diverse for anyone's explanation to ever grab it. But sometimes the systems of spirituality and religion don't allow us to push back on the story or suggest an alternative to it or argue with it or, you know, add a sentence after the last amen or something. But
right.
I never felt that limitation. Like somehow, for some reason, maybe because that first night, I always felt like, oh, you're supposed to talk back in this faith. Like this is a dynamic relational thing that human beings are an essential part of, and we're supposed to contribute to it. And so anyway, I say all of that because that's kind of for me the framing that got me into starting a church in Minneapolis, which we did in 2000. And you know, we were trying to create a context and a place. I've now realized 15 years into it. That some of what we were doing when we started this church was me trying to think about what kind of church would I have wanted to been a part, would I have wanted to have been part of, you know, whatever,
right.
13 years
what
earlier, 17 years earlier.
Yeah.
You know?
What could that conversation have been like on April 1st, 1983?
Yeah.
And how
yeah.
could it
yeah,
have
like,
been different?
Like,
right.
Yeah, so we're all doing that all the time. It's kind of interesting. I mean, this is kind of the way old men talk, you know, they sit around and as you reach older age here. And I think, you know, like, man, I've been playing out certain narratives in my life for some reasons that are sometimes identifiable. You know, you can sort of see it like, hey, that's what's been eating at me all along is that I thought that the way we organized our spirituality should match the narrative that was alive in me as close as it could. And I know for some people, you know, their versions of church and spirituality or whatever do fit the version of the story that's in their head. For me, it's always felt a little elusive. So it feels like a constant process to try to make that or to participate in that or to live up to it in some way, not in a negative way, but sort of in a positive way.
Sure.
And because I didn't come from any religious background or tradition, I have felt the freedom to bounce around in all kinds of Christian streams and even not Christian streams without ever feeling like I was insulting my grandmother. You know, I know I have a lot of other friends
right.
who are deep in their in their family tradition of their faith, and it just carries a different weight to it. You know, I think about my poor kids that are young adults now. I'm like, man, they had to grow up with a religious dad. That's got to make it way harder, you know.
Yeah.
There's kind of a freedom that comes when you grow up without any family pressure on top of everything else. You know?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that's right. You know, I definitely grew up with the, you know, not exactly in the same wavelength as my folks with regards to how I understand the gospel and my understanding of Christianity. And, you know, it's amazing. You know, they love me and they know the work that I've been doing for, you know, many years now. And you know, for a time I really wondered, you know, do they really get this? Do they, you know, you were just talking a little bit earlier about my background, and oftentimes on this show I haven't really shared a lot about the kind of work that I've done over the years. But, you know, when I first started out of seminary, I worked for this wonderful organization called Protestants for the Common Good in Chicago, and I was their director of education and outreach. And so I would go into churches and talk about issues of politics and the common good and, you know, public policy and what needs to change and what needs to happen. And I would talk about it in terms of our faith and what is God calling us to do and be in the world as Christians. And, you know, I was taught growing up that two things you did not talk about in polite company were politics and religion. And here I was, that was what I was doing for a living. I think my poor folks were absolutely mortified, except that great story. My mom is about, you know, 4'10" at this point. And we were in it was here in Chicago, and we're in a big fight in the city council over what they were calling the big box living wage ordinance.
And so we were fighting against big box stores like Walmart and Home Depot who wanted to come into the city and really pay poverty wages. We said, you know, if you want to come into the city, you should pay a living wage. And we based it off of what Costco pays their employees because, you know, here's a model that works, folks. So we know it can be done. And so we actually, when we were fighting this fight, we won the first time in city council. And then the mayor, we actually had a veto-proof majority, but the mayor was against it, and the mayor peeled several of the votes off it. So when it went back for, after the mayor vetoed it and we went back to challenge it, it didn't come through. But there was this period in between when we had the veto-proof majority and we already had the vote, and I was home in Pittsburgh visiting my folks, and I'm walking around the church where I grew up, and my mom is talking to another friend of mine's dad who was standing there, and he's like, oh, you know, Mara is working for this attorney, you know, big law firm in New York, and my mom's like, oh, that's great. She said, well, you know, Jennifer took on Walmart and won, and I turned around, and I looked, and I was like, who is that, and what has she done with my mother?
That's great.
It was the cutest thing I had ever experienced. It, and that was at that point for me, Doug, when I thought, okay, my parents really do get what I do. Because I think initially when I decided, you know, really felt called to go to seminary and decided to go to seminary, I think they were thinking, wow, this is great. Jen's going to be a preacher. We can talk about our daughter, the preacher. This is wonderful. And then I don't go exactly into that route immediately and kind of make this circuitous path through faith and public policy. And I thought, you know, my mom was thinking, geez, OB, I was so looking forward to telling people about my daughter who's a preacher. It just took her another, you know, 15 or so years before she could kind of use those words in the same sentence with me. But yeah, I mean, it is really interesting the way that our backgrounds shape us, either coming out of, you know, a background of not really having grown up with Christianity or with faith versus, you know, being brought up in a faith that was really about salvation. Because even though I was raised in a Presbyterian church, it was a pretty conservative understanding of what faith was about. Faith was about, you know, being saved and going to heaven. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but that never really kind of jived with me until I found myself in an African-American Baptist church in Alexandria, Virginia, where for the first time in my life I experienced a preaching that said to me, wow, you know what? Faith is about more than what's going to happen in the hereafter. Faith is about what we do in the here and now. And I thought, yeah, you know what? This is the Christianity that makes sense and resonates with me.
Yeah. Yeah, and isn't that interesting? There's this was a religious thinker and philosopher named Ken Wilber. We probably talk about him a lot on the show, but Ken Wilber has this sort of frame in this line where he says, you know, the important thing in spiritual growth is to transcend your own past and your own history and your upbringing and your early teachings. You transcend it, but then you also need to include it. And that whole notion of transcending and including, you know, and a lot of us don't narrate our own stories and journeys well enough to sort of keep that transcending and including going. You know, we'll tend to be these change people, you know, like you just, and I'm big into that kind of thing, you know, because I think change is important for people. But the kind of change where you transcend and include is different than where you turn and reject. Because then you just get stuck forever, you know, if you're just in that sort of pushback way. And it's fascinating, isn't it, to think how Christianity like when you read the gospel stories and you sort of see the early days, like how could the story have ever lost that kind of here and now immediacy to it? You know, both like the social way we live in the world, you know, how we live with one another, and the kind of alivened spiritual sense that a fully alive human being should have. It's really amazing. It's almost like it took a concentrated effort of religious people to drive that stuff out of the story, you know? I think it permeates and it radiates so deeply, people want it and they'll find it anyway. You know, they'll just dig it up like old antiques in the attic. And so it's going to always be there. But it just gets covered up so much by our own hands or by our own doing, you know. It's fascinating.
It's like, you know, we're almost afraid that the gospel is true. We're almost afraid that what Jesus was teaching is really true. Because what if it is? And then what does that mean for us in our lives? You know, what does that call us to? Living in different, and I would even argue, kind of deeply subversive ways with regards to our culture and you know, the messages that we are being told. You know, I'm fascinated by the 24-hour news cycle, sometimes repulsed by it and sometimes, you know, really challenged by it. Right now, you know, I mean, what are we hearing in the news? It's all about Ebola. So we have to be afraid of the other, and we have to be afraid of the foreign, and we have to be afraid of people who may not speak our language and don't necessarily look like sort of middle-class white Americans. And, you know, I am just so challenged by that, and really wrestling with, you know, what does this call us to? And I'm not hearing from a lot of folks in the religious community, and maybe they're out there and maybe they're talking about it. But I'm not hearing a lot of it as of yet. There isn't much of a buzz with regards to what should be our response to this crisis. You know, what can we do? What can we do proactively? How can we sort of back off from some of the fear-mongering that we're hearing? I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
And I think it's kind of coming in two waves. You know, there's clearly like the fear of the unknown in any kind of virus. Like the human being, just the human consciousness, just knows how to be afraid of viruses. Like if anything is going to be the end of the human race, it's going to be some plague of a virus, right? So like that really, even without ginning it up, as obviously some, you know, a lot of the news outlets do by trying to grab attention to it, there's something just scary about that to people, right? Like you know,
right.
Movies,
I mean, we've already created,
you know, Walking Dead, all this all this kind of stuff. You know, the most famous show, the most popular show on television is The Walking Dead, and the whole narrative of that is that a virus is spread through humanity, and a few people are survivors, and then the narrative about how do you live in a world that's... I actually think it's a pretty smart show where you're asked to reconsider who's safe and who's not, and, you know, so it's a larger cultural commentary. But like that stuff's really really alive, and I'll tell you, I'm seeing that there's this other shift happening in addition to sort of the always be afraid of the foreigner, and you know, the sort of, you know, reflexive Republican Rick Perry thing about, hey, we should, you know, we should cut off flights to you know, any any country that, you know, has an Ebola breakout. Well, you know, if you take that advice well, we should cut off any flights in and out of Dallas to the rest of the world, right? We should quarantine all of Dallas because what's happening is that people are starting to really push back on expert culture, you know, like, hey, look, if like the people at Presbyterian Hospital and the WHO and all these like experts that are supposed to know about this stuff, like if one guy comes in with the virus and the people who are supposed to figure it out can't figure it out, and then when they do figure it out, they catch it from him, like that is a deeper level of cynicism that's going to run through our culture that I think has some real long-term consequence to it. I'm afraid it's going to have the same effect that happened on me and people maybe both of our generations with Three Mile Island meltdown.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when that nuclear power plant melted down, it caused an entire generation to say, I don't think we can trust scientists. Like, they almost, you know, that's a major screw up, right? Like, that kind of thing.
Boy.
And so what happens then, we end up with this, like, anti-science narrative that runs, which is kind of also an anti-intellectual thing that runs. And anyway, so I pile all that on top of the fact that, like, you know, with, you know, I mean, I was a big Barack Obama fan, and I really wanted the presidency to say that smart, progressive government can be effective. And it hasn't turned out that way, you know, from, you know, I mean, I think he's done lots of really great things. But there's been all these kind of public things of like, yeah, that didn't really work, you know. So there's kind of this movement of like doubting an expert level or institutional doubt thing that's happening, that coupled with, you know, the fear of the outsider and the fear of the stranger and all that stuff and the kind of tribalism. So you realize, like, hey, you can't trust the strangers and your culture, and you can't trust the smart people culture, and you, like, nobody knows, and like there's something in the air here that that I think is I don't know, I don't know, there's something to all that, I think.
Yeah,
and this Ebola thing,
do you think
seems
that
to kind
it
of
goes
this world crashing together, you know,
hand in hand with information being, you know, widely available on the internet. And people also know that they can't trust the information that they get on the internet. So and so it spreads, and it's not just that people can't trust some information or unverifiable information. It's like any information on the internet. It's either sort of like I believe everything I read on the internet, or I don't believe anything I read on the internet. And there's you know, whereas there's sort of a democratization of information sharing, there's also this, you know, real, like you were saying, cynicism and sort of disdain for the expert culture, you know, people who know more about these things than I do. And so where do you see, you know, here we are, this is really postmodern. I mean, this is like post-postmodern. And so the whole narrative of this is the truth, this comes back to your experience on April 1st, 1983.
Yeah.
It's like,
right.
Okay, there was the show. Now this is the truth. And this is absolutely the truth. And
right.
So we don't live in a culture where that will play to young people who've grown up, who were born in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. So
yeah,
so
like I'm driving in my car.
Like,
well, I don't know.
To these folks.
Well,
yeah.
Well, like I'm driving in my car and today and or maybe yesterday and I hear on NPR. You know, I mean, I'm not listening to in my car. I'm not listening to crazy right wingers, but I hear, you know, them say that that the National Institute of Health, the NIH, has updated its protocol for people that deal with Ebola victims. And I'm like, really? You had to update that already? Like, you had it wrong at the start? Like, people followed the like, if the NIH doesn't sort of have, like, the handbook of what you do when somebody has Ebola, which has been around for a long time.
And
they get that wrong. And you're just like, you have got to be kidding me. And I went to a movie last night called Kill the Messenger, which is about a newspaper reporter who wrote a story in the 90s about how the Reagan administration in the 80s allowed the Sandinistas in Nicaragua to sell crack cocaine in the United States to fund that war because they couldn't get Congress to fund the war. So, you know, Oliver North sold weapons to Iran to fund it, and also sold crack cocaine and caused the entire crack epidemic in the United States. And you're just like, you have got to be kidding. And then he gets turned down by the press. And, you know, and I'm a positive guy, and I'm like, you know, you got to be kidding me that all this kind of expert culture, and this is the funny thing, right? There's something about this desire to outsource our responsibilities to these experts, you know, that I think sits at the heart. Like, even the fact that that freaks me out, that the NIH doesn't know, or that the press couldn't find this stuff out about what's going on in the 80s, and you know that we're invading the wrong countries and we're funding the, you know, it's just ridiculous. Well, maybe you have to say, look, this idea that somebody else is going to save us really is this way of kind of outsourcing your the things that matter, right? So, you know, active people movements is the only, and you know, our society, you know, Bill Clinton had this great phrase where he said, there's nothing wrong with America that can't be solved by what's right with America. You know, that's a great line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and like that kind of idea that like, hey, let's remember that, you know, it doesn't take just rules and protocols and knowledge and somebody else is going to solve this, that, you know, life is our responsibility to live and we're supposed to live it the way we are. And I think that religion has faced the same problem, that people have looked at all the religious systems and they're like, it's bullshit. It doesn't work.
Right.
But
right.
That doesn't mean that I'm not going to take it seriously myself, and it doesn't mean that I'm not going to engage in it. It actually calls you to that. So I think all that fear and all that cynicism and all that scarcity and, you know, whatever, you know, expertise should compel us as human beings to be more engaged in the world and take more responsibility rather than less responsibility. So I don't go the libertarian sort of, you know, everyone for themselves, Ayn Rand route. I go just the other way to say, like, okay, well, what we have to do is stop acting as if somebody else has got this, and take a little take a little bit of responsibility for the lives that we're supposed to be. That we're supposed to be leading. And this is the other problem with, like, activist culture, right? Like, you know, and I'm a big part of that world, too, and want to stir up activism and tell people, you know, you need, like, I don't know how many emails you get a day of people asking me to sign petitions and send money.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, good grief, from the president right on down. It's like, are you kidding me?
Right.
I get another one of these emails about, which is all like, hey, here's the new biggest crisis, and you need to help us to solve this problem. Like, oh, my gosh.
Right. And if we don't solve it, you know, this is the end of the world.
Yeah, the end of the world.
You know, I think we Right. It's that we become inured to all of this, that it ceases to have any impact as far as really challenging us to move and to do some things differently. So before we continue our conversation, Doug, I just want to...
So kind of living into your life,
Right. So just want to remind folks that if you're listening live, you're listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. We are here every second and fourth Monday of the month. Most Mondays we're on live tonight. This is a pre-recorded broadcast, which is why we have not jumped in and told you to call in through our regular call-in number. We will be back on the 10th of November, with our next show, which will be live at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central, and yada, yada, yada. So, and I'm here live or recorded with Doug Padgett, who's the founding pastor of Solomon's Porch, and we've been talking about just the challenges of ministry in this day and age and sort of how we both became involved in the progressive Christian movement community. And sort of on that note, why don't you tell folks about Convergence and the new work that's happening with that group?
Yeah, right. Thanks. So one of the things that, you know, it's sort of been for me a common theme of a lot of the conversation we've been having so far is the sort of attitude, well, what are we going to do about it, right? So I felt that about faith mm-hmm. that I entered. I think that about the way people are supposed to live in the world. I kind of have one of those personalities, you know, like if you don't like the world the way it is, you should do something about it. And it's become obvious to me that the old categories of how people organize themselves religiously in North America just don't service us very well any longer. There may have been a time when they did that, you know, if you were in a particular denominational brand, that really carried a lot of synergy for you with other people from your brand, and really pretty much mm-hmm. only other people from your brand. You know, a lot of most denominations have they have an ethnic or historic or tradition background to them, a sort of tribal origins to them. But then, you know, we live in a particularly strange time in human culture, in a strange country where we mix a lot of this stuff up. And so those old boundaries don't work anymore. What it means to be a progressive or a conservative don't mean what they used to mean, those terms. It's not necessarily the case that if you're in a mainline tradition, you know, one of the sort of brand name ones from the turn of the century, that would make you that would put you on a particular continuum of where somebody is, you know, culturally or spiritually or theologically or anything.
Or if
you're an evangelical or a non-denominational person, doesn't necessarily mean that somebody is conservative. You know, for a long time, people thought that if you weren't in a denominational brand, then that sort of meant that you came out of a particular conservative view of the world, you know. And I'm meeting people all the time who are, you know, would come out of a not denominational brand, or maybe were, you know, initiated into Christianity through evangelicalism or something, but are mm-hmm. really progressive in their thinking, in their theology, in their politics, and the way they want to live in the world and how they want to be active. And I meet people who are part of old mainline denominations that are typically liberal, but they're not. And so anyway, all that stuff to say, the old categories don't really work for us as a pathway forward as much as they might work for us as a way to kind of look back and reflect. So mm-hmm. some of us have been thinking like, well, what would these pathways forward look like, and how could and should we organize ourselves if people wanted to continue to work together from this day forward, and not only thinking about how things have been in the past. And so Convergence is an effort to try to convene, advocate, and network people for action together. So those are the kinds of things that we want to do. We want to make introductions of people to each other. We want to hook people up who are already working in ways that that they could be synergistic with others, but often don't have a chance to meet. It's one of the great things that a lot of us have seen from Facebook. You know, if you're on Facebook for any period of time, you begin to realize all the connections that you have to other people that you didn't even know was possible. You know, like you're like, how do we have that person as a shared friend? You know, that kind of thing. And Facebook kind of gives you a lens into your own world and how interconnected you actually are, even if you don't always feel that way. And so I think that's a reality in the world that people are more suited to working together or partnering together than our structures and systems often indicate that we are. So we're trying to figure out what are some kind of para-denominational ways for people to engage. And so we are running some events. We're rethinking theological education. We're trying to think about college-age campus ministries. We're trying to initiate a network of 10,000 spiritual communities around the country that can share resources and best practices with each other. You know, we've got lots of little projects trying to help people in denominations connect, trying to help progressive evangelicals find each other and form some networks. So there's a bunch of things like that we're trying to do.
Well, that's exciting. So what are you hoping that's, really, what is the end game for folks who are listening who may, really be wondering, so this is great, but what are you hoping to come out of this at the end?
Well, our fundamentally, we think that if people can find ways to connect to one another, they will create a more alivened world with a better spiritual heartbeat than if we don't. So ultimately, we believe that will happen when people are connected to each other and are engaged with each other and can co-create together. So ultimately, we believe that's the outcome. That we'll have a heartened and awakened culture and a heartened and awakened spirituality in North America and around the world.
So what has been your role in all of this? And you sound pretty pumped about the direction that things are headed. And how do you see this sort of jiving with the ministry that you've been doing at Solomon's Porch these last nearly 15 years?
Yeah, so like what we've been trying to do at Solomon's Porch is trying to do what I was describing there inside of a community in Minneapolis, right? Trying to say like, hey, what would it look like if people from different backgrounds with from different perspectives were engaged with one another in alivened ways in our spirituality and the way we live our lives. And so our community is doing that, and we're trying to live out a way of being a benefit and blessing to the world, seeing one another as essential conduits and resources for what could make a better world. And so we're trying to, and in a lot of ways, convergence is that on a organizational and national scale, right? It's that same kind of question, like, hey, what would it look like if we did that? And hopefully, and here's what I've learned in 15 years of doing Solomon's, being a part of Solomon's Porch is, if I had projected 15 years ago how we would be living in the world, that would have become a limitation for who we were allowed to become. It's not all that different than, getting married and, having children. You have to live into the next moment. If somebody in that system is determining ahead of time what the valuable outcome is going to be, you're actually going to get in the way of the life that could come. And there's such tendency in our world, anytime something new starts, for people to say, well, what's it going to do and what are the outcomes going to be? And sometimes things,
that
right?
Is our,
but they're
our,
just
right,
not the most, they're just not
tendency.
The most, yeah, mm-hmm. They're just not the most interesting things, right?
Right.
It's like, how many 5-year plans have you ever looked at in your life and really been inspired by it? It's like, geez. But how many? So I have a friend. His name is Claudio Oliver. And he lives in Brazil, and Claudio is a visionary and an activist, and he works on environmental issues from a Christian perspective. And he has this great line where he says, "When it comes to the environment," and I think this is true of lots of other issues of the environment, but he says, "When it comes to the environment, we don't have a problem because problems have solutions. What we have is a grand drama, and grand dramas require multiple responses." And that's such a better way to see the world and to see things that are going on, right? This isn't a problem with a solution. I guess those exist, but they're boring because if you've identified the problem, then you know what the solution is, and now you're just going to bicker over the means to getting there. But there's a more grand drama to life, and I think spirituality and I think this convergence stuff is more about what's this drama that we found ourselves in and what are the multiple responses that we will bring to bear in the midst of that drama.
Right.
And I think that's an inspiring way to view the world.
It taps into certain
temperaments, you know? Yeah. And I know some people are like, I don't even know what that guy's talking about anymore. And other people are like, oh, I love that kind of thing. I just think there are so many places for people to plug in if they want to find a problem and execute a solution. There's a lot of that in the world. There's not a lot of places for people who want to dream about a new possibility as a response to a grand drama. I think we need both of those. We just need places for people to do both those kinds of dreaming. So part of my role in this convergence thing is this business.
And creating space where these kinds of grand dramas can play out.
Mm-hmm.
And appreciating that, like you said, you know, these are not problems with solutions, but these are challenges. These are, you know, dramas that have multiple different ways of looking at them, multiple ways of addressing them rather than solving them. You know, what and how can we live into really what would a new way of, you know, being church, if you will, look like? Mm-hmm. And you know, I know that's something that certainly has drawn me to convergence. Because I want to, you know, help to be, you know, a conversation partner in what does that new church look like? You know, we have multiple ways of being church. My friend Emily Scott, who I'm hoping is going to be on the show in the next month, has been doing a wonderful dinner church that meets on Sunday and now Monday night. So they've gone from one worship service to two, which means instead of meeting on one night a week, they're meeting two nights a week, and they're doing dinner church, and they're, you know, creating a different way of being church. You know, my friend Sarah Buteau in Northampton, Mass., is working with the First Churches in Northampton in order to create another, you know, church service, another congregation within their midst. That's a farm-to-table church that meets on Thursday night that includes children fully in worship, that it creates a space where, you know, we don't have to separate the generations. This is a, you know, a community that's really open to all. And so they've changed even the ways that they do music so that they do a call and response rather than having to look at music and read words. So, you know, I mean, I think it's really exciting the ways that we're seeing this play out in different parts of the country. And I know you and I had met online, but I don't think ever met in person before Christianity 21 last January in Denver. You know, let's talk a little bit about that, because that's a great convergence, if you will, or a meeting of folks who are rethinking what does it mean to be church and what is Christianity going to look like in the 21st century if it's going to remain to be relevant and really speak to the generations that are to come who are dealing with these grand dramas that we're talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, some of what we've tried to do with a particular event is to try to make the event, this one that we call Christianity 21, be a place where people can suggest the expressions of Christianity that are going to make most sense for them. because so we asked 21 people we think have interesting opinions to share one idea each on the future of Christianity in the 21st century. And we have them do it in 21 minutes. So we really play into this Christianity 21 kind of thing. But we, what we're trying to do there is to say, look, there's going to be a lot of ways that people do this. And that's a really good thing because that's how people movements happen. There's multiple responses to it. There's going to be many, many versions of it. Well, I remember when I first got into Christianity, in, like in the 80s and stuff, there was a lot of bemoaning in the groups that I ran around with about how many different expressions of Christianity there were. You know, like somehow a bunch of different denominations seemed like a really bad idea. For whatever reason, the people I was around, like, they thought it would be better if there was, like, I don't know, not all those versions of it. But it's a people movement, you know, from the go all the way back to the Bible days, and you've got a story full of first names, you know, and Jesus doesn't say the same thing to any two people. Like that's meaningful. Right. It's supposed to be an alive community that is shaping and forming, and the Spirit of God is not distinct from the passions of people, and like it's all playing out together. So we're trying to say, like, well, what would a conference look like? You know, if you did a conference, what would that look like if you tried to express it in the same way? So we've tried to do our best to say, well, if you get a bunch of religious leaders together, you know, both professional and unpaid Christian leaders together, what would it look like to have a conversation about the future of Christianity in the world? So, but
well,
you know,
and I think
for
that
me,
you know,
the
format, that format, I thought worked really well to engender conversation among people because, you know, in addition to the 21 leaders that you've identified to give 21-minute talks, we have the 721 talk, which I think is a wonderful format, incredibly challenging from my friends who have developed them, but that's a, you know, where they can express themselves in 7 minutes with 21 slides, which go for 20 seconds each, and, you know, it's, that's a, and so you get, you're not just getting from the folks who you all have identified. It's, you know, people who say, you know, I've got something to say. I've got something to contribute. Let's have a conversation around this. So, I mean, I think that it is a good, so you want to tell folks how they can find out more information if they're interested. It's going to be in Phoenix. I hate to say, Doug, that I am going to be out of the country and I'm going to miss C21.
Come on.
I know.
Where are you going to be?
It's, you know, Phoenix, St. Martin.
Well, that's the problem. We need to think in January.
Challenge. Well, you know, with us moving
elsewhere
to Chicago, it's like, we got to plan a vacation going south, and we actually are going to visit some dear friends down there. So, so it's, you know, I know it's tough duty, but, you know, it's a great time for those of us who live in cold places in the country to come to Phoenix in January, which should be warmer than normal. So is there information that folks can find online about that?
Yes. So if they go to Christianity 21, and 21 is the numbers, 21, Christianity21.com, that'll take them to the place with all the information they need about. So, I mean, it's January 22nd to 24th in Phoenix. You know, it's a couple of days long. And if you're from a cold part of the world, January, Phoenix in January can sound pretty good. At least we're hoping so.
And it's going to be great. And I can vouch for it as last year being my first C21, but certainly not my last. And, you know, there are multiple places where we're gathering to have these conversations in person. You know, we've done it at C21. We've also been gathering, again, more folks at the Wild Goose Festival, which was last couple of summers in North Carolina. So looking forward to that being, you know, a part of the conversation as well. So tell me, I know that you've been feverishly working on a new book that will be published soon. So tell us a little bit about that.
Thank you. Yeah, February 17th is the day they say. It's sort of like the the child's due date. So it's a book called Flipped, and the idea for the title comes from Jesus saying, "You've heard it said, but I say to you." And I like this idea of Jesus flipping the story that's in our head with the story that we should be living in. And the book centers around one particular flip that I think is quite meaningful, and it's one where it comes in the book of Acts when the Apostle Paul says to a group of people, look, God's not in things. God's not in temples, and God's not in idols, and God's not in people. Rather, we live, move, and have our being in God. And this great flip from God is in me or God is in you, as if God is some kind of possessive that we can have, to we live and move and have our being in God, is, I think, this
Which
great
is
flip
a really
that Jesus was getting after. And
notion, yeah.
Yeah.
A really radical understanding of who God is and what God is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I could almost, I mean, I think this is what Jesus has been getting at all along. So I could almost see Jesus being like, I know you've heard it said that you're supposed to have God in you, but I say to you, you live, move, and have your being in God. And that changes the entire orientation of this thing. So so that's what the book tries to do in sort of, you know, common, popular, sort of normal person's language, and tries to inspire people to see that in God sort of way. You know, this, you know, a lot of people want to talk like this, and they kind of already do. You know, they'll say God doesn't exist. God is existence. And so often that has been, that kind of thinking has been set aside for like Eastern thought or Buddhist, like everybody I mentioned this to, they're like, oh, that sounds like what I hear in Buddhism. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's true too. I'm sure Buddhism does say it. But this is what Jesus has been talking about all along, right? You could sort of see Jesus with the woman at the well when she finds out that he's a prophet, and she was talking, you know, rudely to him, and she says, hey, I'm sorry, we worship on the mountain. I didn't know you were a prophet from the temple. And Jesus says, oh, a time is coming and is now, and we won't worship God on the mountain or in the temple, but we will worship God in spirit and in truth. Like, we're just going to see that we're in it all the time, and it's not, God is not bound up in these certain places. And but it also means, you know, this other pushback, which is that we are not God, right? Like, in God doesn't mean you are God. And I think that's a, I mean, just an, I don't even know how to make sense of that dilemma. But, you know, people are, we're not, no one's suggesting that we're God. It's even better than that. It's that we live and move and have our being in God, and that we're that life and God and breath and humanity and energy and spirit is these are indivisible. These are there's just a really great notion that the Jews would have called it the Shema of God. You know, it would have been that call of Moses, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one." Yeah, and that didn't mean there was one. It wasn't talking about the number of gods. It was saying God is one. Right? It's indistinguishable, which is why for the Hebrews, they didn't name God. You didn't give God a name. Just God just was I am, because you only named something that was yours to possess, and you wouldn't do that with God. So, but, you know, I mean, that hasn't stopped a lot of religions, including Christianity, from building the entire thing around God is a possessive.
It really hasn't, unfortunately. Right. I always sort of picture Jesus sort of with his head in his hands going, no, that's not what I said.
Right. Yeah, it's really,
You've taken me out of context again.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
And you know, I see things through a religiously through a Jesus lens. So, you know, I try to figure out like what was Jesus getting at, and so there's lots of these stories and, you know, of interactions and teaching of Jesus where it feels like, boy, I know we've heard it said that it went like this, but I think Jesus might be saying this. And if you see it through the in God frame, it really makes a different story for us.
Well, I just want to, you know, we're coming to the end of our hour, and I want to give you an opportunity to just tell folks where they can, you know, find flips or find more information about Solomon's Porch or about the other books. I know this is not your first book. There are many out there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've written
a
another one.
A place where
yeah,
they can
so
go to find others.
Yeah, so I have a website that bears my name, and that's Doug Paget, P-A-G-I-T-T, .com. And you can that'll take you to events and take you to lots of other places. It can serve as a bit of a portal to all these other things that I do, churches and books and conferences and networks and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, and that's great. And so for anyone who's listening, if you are wanting to learn more about Doug and the work that he's doing, the books and the conferences and convergence, please go to DougPaget.com. If you are interested in learning more about the show, wanting to make sure that you're kept up to date on what is happening and who are going to be our guests on upcoming shows, please like us on Facebook. We're Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. We are on the Life Coach Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio. That's because I do life and leadership coaching as well as spiritual direction, and you can find any information that you might need about me at Jennifer Hope Kotler, and that's KOTTLER.com. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, Doug, so much for being
you,
on the
Jen.
Show. And have a great evening, everyone, and be back here on November 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central. And we're looking forward to talking with you live and coming to you live then. God bless everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Good night.
Bye-bye.